Happy afternoon, parish orphans and retrogrades. Today, I will be talking about the directional challenge to Catholic conservatives. It besets us. What to do now, Western man? What to do now, Western Catholic conservative? And with me, I've got Mr. Eric Sammons, who recently wrote a stupendous article on his own crisis. The pages of Crisis Magazine. He is editor there. He has a new book out called Deadly Indifference, and he's with me right now. What's up, Eric?
Not too much. Thanks for having me on. This is a good topic to talk about.
Yeah, this is, in some ways, it's the topic to talk about because we're at a time that I've identified as a kind of deadly time for the conservative, particularly the Catholic conservative. It's the post-Trump era, marked by a kind of populism, which I think is a very healthy energy, a kind of angry-ish populism, almost like the Sons of Liberty, but this time rejects the spirit of the Sons of Liberty, you know, the Samuel Adams type that went against the crown in the early 1770s, because this type of populism rejects all notion of kind of patriotism, particularly American patriotism. It rejects all notions of limited government. It's a deadly hour for conservatism, conceived as a political ideology qua small state. So what do you say about that? In your article, which is absolutely dynamite, you write, it's called The Political Path for Conservative Catholics. You lay out something you call natural law libertarianism, very close to my own political ideology. What is natural law libertarianism?
Right. So essentially what it means is that the state has a very limited role. That's where the libertarian part comes in. I know that the name libertarian automatically gets some Catholics their hackles up and like, oh, wait, I'm not libertarian. That's libertinism. And they just want to smoke dope and stuff like that.
Right.
So, but what I'm saying is the libertarianism part of that is that the state has a very limited role, very minimal role in the life of its citizens, but it does have a role. Like a lot of libertarians today will go all the way to anarchy and say that it has no role whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But I would say that it has a role in enforcing natural law, things that we know, men and women know, just by the fact that we exist and we have reason, we know. So for example, we know intuitively that murder is wrong. That if I kill somebody in cold blood, innocently, that is wrong. And the state has the authority to punish that. But if it goes beyond natural law, and here we're talking about even divine revelation. So for example, if it says something like baptism, like, you know, baptism, obviously we all should be baptized, but it's a grace. We know it's a grace to be baptized, to even want baptism. And so the state can't enforce that and say, you must be baptized. It doesn't have the authority to do that. Also, it can't enforce what we see more likely today is all the nitpicking things of like the Department of Education or all those. I mean, my goodness, every department of practically in the federal government has nothing to do with natural law, because it's not natural law that you have to educate your kids in a government sanctioned school. And so that's basically what natural libertarianism is that government, the state, should only stick to enforcing natural law in the life of its citizens.
Yeah, I want to make a stark example. Natural law libertarianism, I would call it natural law minarchism for the reason you...
That's more accurate.
That it basically gives right. A lot of sort of brainwashed Catholics seizures. You know, right. If you say the L word, libertarianism. So call it natural law minarchism, or just my preferred Thomistic minarchism, which is basically the same thing. It becomes a stalking horse to say, oh, well, just make murder illegal. This is the way that it's caricatured by a lot of folks along the Catholic populist, right, who would oppose you or I. They'd say, oh, murder's like the only thing you want illegal. No. The purview of the state, the legislative purview of the state, is quite a bit more expansive than that. I like how your article enumerates marriage between a man and a woman. That is a natural law precept. That is not a supernatural law precept. Also, a potential stalking horse would be the idea of the infamed case of Edgardo Mortara. I support the Vatican in the case, the 19th century case of the baptism and hijacking, as its opponents call it, of Edgardo Mortara by the Vatican, because that is a sacred state, the one sacred state in the world anymore. But for secular states who simply, according to Bellarmine, Suarez, Leo XIII, does not any longer at this point in the world after the dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire have the purview, have the competence to adjudicate which version of Christianity, even if we assume Christianity is correct, to stay to hands off in secular states. But you're great, your article's great because it enumerates that natural law libertarianism is not anarchy. I call it natural law or Thomistic minarchism because it's decidedly not anarchy. It literally would be like marriage between a man and a woman. Yes. Drag queen story hour. This too can be legislated by the state. What do you, this might be a little in depth, but what I said two summers ago to Sohrab Amari in private messaging, when he was debating David French on Drag Queen Story Hour, I said, look, man, I don't know how else to say it, so I'll just be bold. This is a false dichotomy. You're saying the federal government must legislate the morality against Drag Queen Story Hour. David French is saying no level of government can or should be doing this because he's being characterized as the libertarian. The natural law libertarian or the Thomistic minarchist, like me, would say precisely what I did say, the police power of the 10th Amendment. There is a role for the state to legislate this. And the United States 10th Amendment says it should be happening by the individual states who have right. The power to regulate or legislate the kind of morality relating to health, safety, welfare, morals, security. That's
right.
The 10th Amendment power. So isn't this, we don't want to call it a Catholic third way, but it is something of a middle way. It's federalism. States have this power to legislate morality, even though we're basically libertarians when it comes to the legislative purview of the Fed.
Right. And it's funny you use minarchism because that's actually how I define myself. I'm a minarchist, but most people don't even know what that means. And minarchism falls generally under the umbrella today, at least, of libertarianism. And that's exactly what it is, though, in the sense that, first of all, the further away a government is, i.e. Washington, D.C., or if even a state at the state level, state capital, the further away it is, the less authority it has, because it doesn't have that subsidiarity where it's directly connected with the people and the community. But ultimately, though, the community, and here's where I think a lot of libertarians get it wrong, is they think the community can decide just whatever they want to be, the morality want to be. So for example, San Francisco can say, hey, we love Drag Queen Story Hour. That's just the greatest thing. We want to have that all the time. And some libertarians will say, yeah, that's great. You can do that. But what we're saying is that there is a standard, the Thomistic standard, the natural law standard, by which we are all bound to. Because here's an issue I think most Catholic social teaching, I feel like, hasn't even explored this issue. And that is the morality of the state using force to make something happen. Because something we have to remember, whenever the state has a law, they are enforcing that at the point of a gun. Because, for example, if you don't pay your taxes, if you jaywalk even, if you do anything against the law, ultimately, if you keep on fighting it, eventually they will point a gun at your head and take you to jail. If you resist, and if you resist, they'll shoot you. There's a morality there of allowing somebody to be able to morally point a gun at your head and force you to do something. And I would say the state only has that authority when it's something that the person is essentially can know through the use of reason. Now, obviously, we know a lot of people deny their reason today, and they think men can say they're women or boys can marry men or whatever they say these days. But the fact is, we know down deep that they know it by reason alone. And therefore, the state can have that authority to use force, violence, essentially, in order to enact those type of laws, like you can't murder, you can't rape, but even men and women, only men and women can be married. Otherwise, it just seems to me that it's crazy to think that it's moral for somebody to be able to put a gun to my head and say, you have to pay for the local library. I just think that there's an issue there, because like the drag king story hour is often at public libraries. I would even go a little bit further and say, I don't really think the state has the authority to set up libraries. I think, you know, communities can set up libraries freely. Right. They don't need to have the state, you know, our forced donations through taxes right. to do it.
Yeah. I mean, who gave us the library? By us, I mean, humanity, Western civilization, the Roman Catholic Church, not the Roman Empire. And Catholics that LARP and want to go back to the Holy Roman Empire, remember, it's the Catholic Church, a private institution right. that gave us libraries, universities, hospitals, a lower ed, higher ed, everything. Yeah, absolutely. But what, and I love everything you're saying, except I'd push on this one issue. Catholic social teaching, Eric, is very, very specific about the teaching that this dominion that the state has on violence, this monopoly on violence enjoyed by the purview of the state, is grave evil when it's used wrongly. And that is articulated very expressly by Pius XI in Quadragesimo Anno. He literally says, under the heading of subsidiarity, because, I mean, he doesn't say this part, it's the subtext, because the state enjoys the sole monopoly on the use of violence for disobedience, unlike any of the other institutions in society, because it has such a grave disproportionate advantage over all the other institutions, therefore it is a grave evil, meaning mortal sin, when any bigger government, any further away sphere of government, takes the power of any more local, smaller government who ought to have the powers front-loaded. They have right of first refusal. So Catholic social teaching and the 20th century popes have indeed weighed in on this matter because of the specific allusion to the state's monopoly on violence. This is the whole justification morally for subsidiarity. So it's not actually a point that Catholic social teaching is mute on. Big government is fundamentally grave evil.
Yeah, I see it as there's Catholic social teaching and there's Catholic social teaching. By that, I mean the second one is what everybody says is Catholic social yeah. teaching. Because everybody yeah. who advocates and loves to talk about Catholic social teaching, every single solution they have is the government needs to force people to do something.
Right.
And they say that's Catholic social teaching. But as you articulated, and I need to look that one up, because I'll just be honest, I didn't know about that specific case of talking about the moral obligations of a government, because it is the only one with this authority. So that's great to know. But if you notice, when the advocates for Catholic social teaching are out there, every answer is always the government. If you look at it closely enough, is the government needs to do something, meaning the government needs to use their monopoly on violence to force people to do something.
Yes. Yes. It also, it's codified in Quadragesimo Anno, right? Where it's called a grave moral evil, a mortal right. sin for the government to do that when it's doing a single act in the purview of a more local sphere of government. But it's also implicit in the Aristotelianism that was imbibed by Thomas and the Dominicans and really gave us a Catholic virtue ethics, right. Aristotle's natural law ethics, because Aristotle has this whole system whereby there, you basically, when you're adjudging whether or not you're virtuous with regard to a given virtue, there are four planes you can exist in. The first plane is you're purely vicious. You do the wrong thing and you're mostly ignorant of the right thing. And therefore you get pure pleasure from doing the wrong thing, pure vice. The next one is incontinence, where you do the wrong thing still. You haven't tried doing the right thing yet, but it begins to pain you because you've been keenly aware, maybe through some example of one of your friends, that you can do the right thing and the right thing is right, but you still don't dare to try the right thing yet. The next realm, according to Thomas and Aristotle, is continence, where you cross some sort of dotted line in the sand, where you begin like a clunky beginner at anything, trying to do the right thing, but you're not doing it with the right form. You don't know the right time to do it. You don't have the proper motive. And the main thing is the test. After you do the right thing, the test is, do you have pleasure? A truly virtuous man, which is the fourth realm, will get pleasure from doing the right thing afterwards for the sake of the right thing itself. That's the big test, Aristotle and Thomas say. You will not get that pleasure the first time you try giving charitably. You'll wish you had your money back. Virtue, you do the right thing and you get pure pleasure. You do it in the right way, right time, right motives, and with a perfect form, like watching a great jump shooter. So the difference between those two middle realms is what concerns the purview of legislation when it comes to legislating moralities. The two middle realms are those which immediately separate the act where you begin doing a right thing. Continence, you do the right thing for the first time and it pains you. Incontinence, you do the wrong thing and it pains you. You see how that works? And the reason this is so important to the question of the legislation of morality is because Aristotle and Thomas both explicitly tell us the most that a law that through the threat of insinuated violence over which the government enjoys monopoly, the most it can get you is to realm three, from incontinence to continence. Hey, if you don't do this, you'll pay a fine or you go to prison. But continence is not true virtue. It is the realm of what Aristotle and Thomas call accidental virtue. So legislating morality cannot get us to true virtue, expressly taught by Aristotle, Thomas, Bellarmine, all the guys that accept Aristotle, basically the church. It can only get you to a false accidental form of virtue called continence. That's a really important piece of the equation that usually the integralists just don't know or don't espouse.
Yeah, and it's this idea that somehow, we've heard legislate morality always comes from the left these days, that like any type of law. But the fact that, and so what happens, I think conservatives automatically react to it and go the opposite way. Like, okay, the left says you can't legislate morality, so we should let abortion be legal. And so the conservatives rightly say, well, no, obviously morality and law are connected. You can't separate them as if they're not connected in some way. And the fact is that by having laws, well, first of all, you're protecting the innocent, but also people do end up seeing, okay, there is a model, so to speak, of right living by the law, can if it's done properly. But I do think then we go to the reaction of, okay, now let's start legislating all good things. And right. It's not a matter of legislating good things, like, you know, legislating becoming Catholic, for example. And because that then becomes, like you just said, it becomes this forced action where obviously somebody becomes Catholic specifically because they take pleasure in it. I mean, to use the language, you know, you were using before, obviously there's grace that comes in, things like that. Well, some external force that's basically telling them, okay, you'll probably have a gun to your head if you don't do this. Clearly, that's not an acceptance of a true exception of Catholicism, where that fourth level of, okay, I'm taking pleasure in the fact that I want to be Catholic, I want to be baptized, whatever the case may be. And I think that's where, I think both the integralists and the kind of more libertarians get that wrong, because the integralists, like you were saying, they kind of think somehow that by making it a law, people will now find joy in it and will want to do it. But I do think the libertarians on the other side, they make it like, sometimes like, a law is almost worthless. It doesn't keep people from doing anything. All people are going to do it anyway. But right. That is totally not true. People, I mean, if there were no laws against murder, the murder rate, I guarantee, would skyrocket, because that's what happened with abortion. I mean, that's exactly what happened. When it was illegal, there was a lot less of them.
Right.
And they try to act like it was everybody's getting it by the coat hangers before. That's been debunked a million times. No, the fact is people started having abortions much more once it became legal. So on both extremes, we kind of have to say, no, let's stick to what the good of the law has its usefulness in morality, but it's a limited usefulness in that.
100%. And also the libertarians are wrong. The extreme libertarians are wrong when they say that the law, through the insinuated use by the government of violence, does not have a prohibitive value. That's ridiculous, right? For all of the morally mediocre people, it's demonstrably false. But more than that, the less extreme libertarians will say, well, yes, the law changes behavior, but it doesn't have it doesn't even insinuate a morally instructive value, which is also wrong. More of the mediocre people that are on the borderline between incontinence and continence will definitely do the behavior and have it more normalized and habituate it more easily, the bad behavior. They will more easily eschew the idea that we must habituate the good behavior. So absolutely, the law does have some instructive value. Aquinas, and what I call Thomistic minarchism, my position, only it, but it says, as I think you're saying, Eric, it has a very limited morally instructive value, so much that it can get you from vice, the threat of government violence, to incontinence, even to continence, doing the thing itself. But where it can't get you is true virtue, doing the right thing for the right reason. At the most, it can get you to doing the right thing for the wrong reason, and thereby by changing your habits and your character some, but it can't get you all the way to pure virtue. One dense quote from Thomas from the Summa that I have memorized is, not all vice must be prescribed, just as not all virtue must be mandated. And Thomas, in another place, gives the famous example that prostitution does worse for society when it is made illegal. It's definitely a vice. He's definitely a master of chastity, a famous master of chastity. But he gives the example of prostitution, which makes it all but impossible for the integralist or the Catholic post-liberal to posit their right-wing big government conservatism, if such a thing exists.
It seems like today that a lot of Catholics and conservatives, is what I'm really talking about, they assume that, like, if you're not against something being made illegal, that means you're for the activity.
Right.
And there's a perfect example where nobody would ever claim that St. Thomas is for prostitution, would think it's a virtue, think it's good in any way, shape, or form. But the limited aspects of the law make it where he was willing to accept that it could be better. And I personally think, like, the prostitution issue, there's a perfect example of where you can't just say it's the Catholic position that should be made illegal. I think what you should say is, let's debate in the situation, in each situation, should it be made illegal or not based upon the community you live in. Like, if you're in Ave Maria, Florida, or something like that, wherever it's, yeah, go ahead. I mean, you know, whatever, if it's illegal, that's fine. But I feel like we make it, it sounds like you support prostitution these days if you say, yeah, I don't think there should be a law against it. And that's just that they're not the same. The morality and law are related, but they're not identical. And I think conservatives have gone down this path of in recent years of making anything they don't like, therefore we have to make it illegal. Or somehow we have to use the government to make it fix. You see this with a lot of conservative Republicans these days, which isn't always the same thing. But if they like something, if they want some result, they're like, okay, how can we get the federal government to make that result happen? Here in Ohio, J.D. Vance is running for Senate. And I will admit, I've read his book, Hillbilly Elegy. I liked it. I thought it was very good. I mean, his grandparents grew up in a very similar background to my own father. And so I really identified with it. And I live in the area where he is. So I haven't really looked into his candidacy for Senate yet and whether or not I'd vote for him, like that. But I'm disturbed by the fact that he seems to be very quick to say, we don't like this happening. Let's use the federal government to fix it our way. Well, the problem is that goes both ways then. I mean, because you've basically undercut the whole argument when the left does that. You say, oh, that's not the government's role. But you just said the government's role was to increase taxes on these things and decrease them on this shift in order to make what you want to happen. So you're basically now just arguing over the semantics of how to use the big government.
Yeah, you make an excellent point in your article. You say the debate between integralists and Catholic libertarians is one that should be encouraged in Catholic circles, certainly, rather than yelling at each other, we should debate. Although I'm clearly much closer to the libertarian end of this spectrum, you write, I've been happy to publish articles here at Crisis that advocate for an integralist viewpoint. Again, it's not a matter of trying to find the mythical Catholic political system, which you eschew earlier as trying to find the Catholic third way, and I'm with you on that, but instead engaging in a healthy debate as to the best means to fight the massive secular state. All reasonable Catholics agree that the massive secular state is a problem that needs to be addressed. The question becomes, in our work to overcome the MSS, do we focus on minimizing the massive or Catholicizing the secular? And then that's your closing line. What you're referring to is the dangerous impulse by populism, right-wing populism, post-liberalism, or integralism, basically the same thing the way I'm using them, to make into a stalking horse that which one posits for legality or illegality as their favored moral position. And that's not it. But on the other extreme, What's also not it is a complete legal positivism, which says that there is no overlap between morality and legality. There's overlap, but it's just Thomistic overlap, which has this boundary, which is defined in the ways we've laid out here. So I think it's really, really, really key to note that there isn't a the natural law libertarianism, which I think is the best understanding of this here below. It is not a Catholic third way. Why do you insist? And I agree with this, but I'm wondering, can you articulate to the people out there who are scratching their heads, well, if this is the best conception here below in the imperfect contingent world for Catholic political economy, why isn't the natural law libertarianism you describe in your article a Catholic third way?
Well, I think the real issue comes down to the fact that the church has given us guidelines. It gives us principles for how government should be run. But in my reading of what the church has always taught and the popes have taught about this in various church documents is that how that is applied in the actual world today, and when I say today, I mean every day, so today or 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, all over the world, that's up to Catholics then to figure out what's the practically the best way we apply these principles to the modern world, whatever the modern world might be. It's not a matter of there is this mythical like Catholic political system that if we just implement that, everything is taken care of. So, for example, how, like you mentioned already, like the Vatican State, that's a political state. That's very different. 19th century Vatican, for example, political state versus the whole, you know, Holy Roman Empire from previous generations or America today. And so how we think practically the best way to do that is going to matter because, for example, if you live in an anarchy, you're going to want to push for more laws. If you live in a totalitarian society, communist Russia, or what we're becoming, you're going to want to go less laws. The practical point of what I'm saying is I find too many Catholics want to debate the theoretical about, okay, what's theoretically this Catholic state that would just be perfect? Well, we live under original sin. There is no such thing. And so what we have to face today is this, what I call the massive secular state. So massive, not meaning that we're the biggest governments that ever existed, but massive in that what it covers, every aspect of our life. I mean, the Roman Empire at its height did not have control over all its citizens' daily tasks like ours does today. It's secular in that it's explicitly supposed to have nothing to do with religion. That's what we live under, and that's what we have to address. When we start talking about like a Catholic state, I admit I start to just zone out and say, that's just some pie in the sky. You're living in a different universe than me because that ain't happening. That means you want Cardinal Gregory to be helping, you know, do laws, or Cardinal McCarrick back in the day and stuff like that.
You also write in your article, which is a great point. It's like you want Wilton Gregory as emperor.
Yeah. I mean, essentially that's what an integrist state would do. Cardinal Supich, those guys would all be helping determine law and things like that, which would just be a disaster. So I'm also, the reason I'm pushing that there's not a mythical Catholic state, because I feel like it stops debate. Because when one guy says, my view is the Catholic view, well, then two Catholics can't even disagree, because as soon as you disagree, you're called a heretic. You're labeled a heretic. And I feel like, no, if some integralist wants to argue his point, I'm going to say, that's fine. Argue your point. Let's debate it and determine what is that really what we should be talking about these days and things like that. But at the same time, I'm even willing to entertain a Catholic anarchist, so to speak. I mean, I think he's wrong on some key points, but I'm not going to just demonize him and call him a heretic for thinking that, because I really think there's a lot of debatable points when it comes to the practicality of how we run our societies, how we run the state.
Agreed. Listen to Pope Leo XIII, with which many integralists assume hold their view. He writes, whatever therefore in things human is in any way a sacred character, whatever belongs either of its own nature or by reason of the end to which it is referred, to the salvation of souls or to the worship of God, falls wholly within the power of the church and wholly subject to her judgment. He's contrasting that to being wholly under the power of the state. Most integralists would be shocked to hear him say this. Suarez wrote this, who's, you know, writes well before Vatican II. Suarez writes this. As regards this area, he's talking about religion. Civil authority is more limited now within the church than it was before the Christian religion. For once the care of religion was oriented towards the virtue and happiness of the commonwealth, as we noted above from St. Thomas, but now religion itself and spiritual salvation and spiritual happiness are the priority and the rest for their sake. And therefore, while once the care of religion either belonged to the authority of the ruler or was joined with that authority in one and the same person or was subordinated to the authority of the ruler, now, however, the care has changed, right? He goes on. So, I mean, this is not something that comes from, springs at like Athena from Zeus's head out of Dignitatis Humanae. This is also in Cardinal Bellarmine writes extensively about it. So it's
also
Bellarmine's
not Americanism. Part. And that's what you hear a lot is that, that this idea of a minimal government only comes from this Americanist idea. And we're just following Jefferson and people like that. And so it's not Catholic at all. That's what I hear a lot is like this idea that, I mean, especially those who aren't as maybe critical of Vatican II, but they're integralists, what they'll do is they'll say, well, you're just like spouting Americanism. You're too influenced by the individualism of American. And the fact is though, a minimal government is not individualistic. It's not because it's not telling people, okay, you live on your own or something like that. It's in fact helping the flourishing of voluntary communities, of the church, of neighborhoods, whatever, to work together. I mean, I don't know about you, but like I want government to have almost nothing to do with my life, but that doesn't mean I don't think the community doesn't matter. I mean, my parish, my city, all these things matter to me because, you know, we can't do it on our own. So I've heard that a lot where if you try to argue for a minimal government, the assumption is you're just this Americanist, pull up your own bootstraps, individualist, which is not Catholic. And I'm saying now what you're confusing is the state versus our human communities. A community is not the state. I mean, that's the big thing is voluntary community of your parish, of your diocese even, or just your neighborhood and family, obviously, is being the biggest one. That all matters for how we go about living our lives. And so we're not being Americanists when we advocate for this limited government, because as you've already quoted, those people were not, they were before the American Revolution. They were talking about this stuff.
Right. There's, Eric, there's a little book called The Political Writings of St. Robert Bellarmine by Father Rager. And this book, for all of these McCarthyite Americanists, and Joseph McCarthy has been more than vindicated by the Venona Papers, by the way, but we'll call them Americanist McCarthyists. They need to read this book. It is shocking. Bellarmine writes everything associated with good founding era Americanism. I mean, subsidiarity, I mean, natural rights, and I mean, popular sovereignty. So much so that in the Anglican days, he debated not only the king and the king's main guy, his right-hand man, hated Robert Filmer, who was also hated by John Locke and Algernon Sidney. They were great students of Bellarmine's, if they were a little bit plagiaristic. He debated the Anglicans on the issue of divine right of kings. And, you know, as you can imagine, Bellarmine was way against it. So much so that there was a college, an Anglican college, erected called the Anti-Bellarminiarum. And at this college, they taught divine right of kings, and they taught about how the papists had long held against the ideas of what we would today call integralism, divine right of kings. And the papists, like Bellarmine, had always held since early medieval days, 1200, 1300, really, this comes from Thomas Aquinas, held that popular sovereignty, individual rights, the right of rebellion, which comes from Thomas Aquinas, and subsidiarity are the thing, and that the divine right of kings is bunk made up Anglican hogwash, which it is. The sides are wholly reversed, right, as according to the minds of Catholic integralists. I haven't been very successful in popularizing this plain brute fact of history, however.
Yeah, and there's this idea that somehow, you know, I freely call myself a traditional Catholic, and I don't shy away from the term. But I found in traditional circles, there's this idea that you're now supposed to, if you're a traditional Catholic, you're now supposed to support this idea of a Catholic integralist state. And I'm just like, if you look, you know, at all the way back to Thomas and before that, you see there's this whole thread among Catholic thinkers. I mean, and we're not talking like some obscure theologian out in the middle of nowhere. We're talking about the big boys like Bellarmine, like Thomas. They clearly are pushing towards a limitation of the state. In fact, that is one of the great things that Christianity has done to the world, because there was nothing to hold back a state from doing anything it wanted to. And you see that when a state like, I mean, look at, I'm reading right now about the Russian Revolution. And of course, everybody today is like, I'm not advocating for the czars or anything like that, Tsarist Russia. However, you will see Tsarist Russia, which was Orthodox Christian, was a lot more free than what replaced it. The atheistic idea of that, because the idea that the state just controls your entire life, that's a very atheistic idea. But the integralists end up embracing that because they want to control things that are beyond the purview of the state. So it's really an atheistic idea in my mind to think that the state should be telling us what to do, because if you don't have God and your connection, I mean, yes, we're not Protestants where we think our whole relationship is between the individual and God. Yet at the same time, there is a relationship between the individual and God, and that is how we are judged. And so therefore, as Christians, we see that. So we don't have to have the state telling us what to do all the time, because, you know, we have this natural law, we have grace and things like that. But the atheist has nothing. So what do they do? They make the state God, and therefore the state has to do everything. I think that's a real foundational point. You see it very clearly in the left, of course, but I think you're seeing it in the right, where the right today is often saying, we have this problem, we need the state to fix it. And I mean, that's because we don't have anything other than the state. And partly that has to do with the fact that we have such a weak Catholic Church today. I mean, if we had a strong Catholic Church that was preaching morality and preaching virtue, then I think, you know, you'd have people practicing virtue more, because it's when people start to get less virtuous that more laws come in, because you don't have that, just that normal, like the idea that there should be a drag queen story hour shouldn't be something that would you conceive of in a good culture, a Catholic culture that is truly strong. They wouldn't even like, and a boy saying, or a guy saying, I'm now a female, that wouldn't even be conceived of in a culture that was imbued with a real Catholic ethos and a Catholic way of looking at things.
Absolutely. Now, you touched on it a second ago, Eric. Maybe we'll close with this. I call it the monarchism paradox. Those like us who are traditional Catholics, who love the patrimony of the church, Latin, chant over hymns, we like the traditional Latin mass. Not all of them, but, you know, something to the tune of 9 out of 10 of them are going around as either post-liberals or integralists or monarchists or some combination of the three. These tend to be, and I'm talking about the 9 out of 10, and that's not a scientific guess, tend to be the types that claim generically in the genus to like monarchy. But they, when we look at the one monarchy that still stands in the world today, the monarchy of Rome, you know, the Catholic monarchy, they tend to be the most fast to eschew or to rationalize or to disobey the really, really strong dictates that come not from Vatican II, but from Vatican I of the Pope. Like, I don't like it. I'm not a fan of Pope Francis. I'm one of his earlier critics compared to other talking heads. I started writing articles against him in Crisis in 2014, long before Amoris Laetitia, by over 2 years. Big critic of Francis. He's the worst pope yet. But according to Vatican I, not Vatican II, it's a monarchy, and you combine Vatican I with Vatican II, and you get a real catastrophe, a monarchy that we have to obey pretty much in all ecclesial matters. You get one guy that's as bad as Pope Francis, or even as bad as Pope Paul VI, and all of a sudden he's messing with our most sacred disciplines. And we have to just sit there and take it. So there's something like a monarchism paradox among the, let's call them the integralists. Do you see this as well? Isn't it kind of strange? The ones that like monarchy in the secular state reject it in the sacred state where we have to accept it.
Right. It is an interesting thing because we're seeing a monarchy when it has a true, not a constitutional monarchy or anything like that, but a true monarchy. We're seeing how it plays out, and it's not so fun, because the whole point is all power is in the hands of a very few, and no matter how remote you are, you abide by it. Now I've seen, and I'll put myself in one of these, that there is the idea that like, how do we interpret Vatican I and how much of a monarchy, how much power does the Pope have in that sense? I mean, obviously he has universal jurisdiction. It's very clearly stated, but how should that be practiced and things like that are always a question. But I do think it is interesting that, I mean, I'll be honest, when people start advocating for monarchy, I mean, I love reading about monarchies, by the way. I mean, I'm reading about the czars of Russia right now. I like reading about the history of the English monarchs and things like that. I'm a big fan of just reading about and learning about the history. But I feel like it's just like, it's a completely impractical, pie in the sky, fantastical idea that there's going to be some type of monarchy instituted in the modern world. Maybe if we had a total collapse of society, and which, you know, could happen, maybe at that point it could happen or something like that, but it's just not going to happen. And so what is the point of talking about it? Because, I mean, just look at today, our president has far too many powers. And I saw so many conservatives when George W. Bush was doing his stupid stuff, they were applauding it. And then when Obama did literally use the exact same stupid laws that were created under Bush to give Bush power, they hated it. I'm like, but the whole point is you gave the president those powers. You just happened to think Bush was a good guy, and so therefore it will be okay. But once a guy you don't like, Obama, comes in, you don't like it. And the same thing is true with Trump and Biden. I mean, it's the same thing that we've given, conservatives have allowed the president to have all these powers to make him, he's not a monarch, but man, he's going that direction. He's becoming a dictator that he has power to do almost anything. And we cheer it when our guy gets it. But I'm like, well, hold on. You're not going to like it when your guy doesn't get it. And it's the same thing in the Catholic world. You love it when Pius X has it, but you hate it when Pope Francis has it. So it does become a paradoxical view that it just seems odd that I could see, you know, the monarchy in the sacred world, in the church. You can argue, I mean, if anything, you got to argue the other way around. You got to argue just for it in the sacred world, where there is a voluntary association, first of all, because you've decided that you're part of the Catholic Church by your own choice. Therefore, you abide by all the rules and regulations and laws of that church. Whereas in a secular state, you didn't voluntarily choose to where you were born or where you live. And that's why a monarchy in that situation can really lead to a lot of problems, because the monarch has a power over you that no human should have over another person when it comes to just living and involuntary things like where you were born.
Yeah, Aristotle, Plato, Thomas, and Bellarmine all make reference to this fact that it's indisputable when a monarchy is functioning on all fours, it's the best form of government. But 9 out of 10 times you get soft tyrants or hard tyrants, at least soft tyrants, in the place of monarchies. And when you get those, which are the most numerous instances, it's the worst form of inverted government. There are three regimes: monarchy, aristocracy, republic. Monarchy is the best when it's good, but it's not often good. There aren't that many good men. Therefore, Thomas and Bellarmine urge that we hedge our bets with some sort of mixed regime. And it's a bet hedging thing. Listen to what Vatican I says about our monarchy, our Roman pontifical monarchy. So this is section 9 of one of the two documents. I don't have the title here. The main one cited from Vatican I. So then, if anyone says the Roman pontiff has merely an office of supervision and guidance and not the full and supreme power of jurisdiction over the whole church, and this not only in matters of faith and morals, but also in those which concern the discipline and government of the church dispersed throughout the whole world, that he has only the principal part of that power, but not the absolute fullness of the supreme power, or that this power of his is not ordinary and immediate, both over all and each of the churches and over all and each of the pastors and faithful. Let him be anathema. The main part there is in the middle part of that quote. It's intimidating. This is a section, the honor due to bishops who are like sovereigns in their own right, from the Council of Trent. The apostle, Paul, also teaches that they are entitled to obedience. Obey your prelates and be subject to them. And they watch, for they watch as being to render an account of your souls. Nay, more, Christ the Lord commands obedience even to wicked pastors. This is Council of Trent. Upon the chair of Moses have sitten the scribes and Pharisees. All things, therefore, whatsoever they shall say to you, observe and do. But according to their works, do ye not, for they shall say and do not, like Jesus says. Do what the Pharisees say. Don't do as they do. We're stuck with wicked pastors. They're like little kings. The Bishop of Rome is the big king. But like you said, Eric, let's not spread the idea of having more kings, because we don't have to have them in the secular realm. We have to have at least one in the sacred realm. And that's risk enough, which is why Thomas Bellarmine Suarez started advocating away from kings. And Bellarmine definitely advocated against the idea of divine right of kings. We need to popularize this point of view. I hope you do some of this in your book, Deadly Indifference. Can you tell people where they can get that?
Yeah, you can go to sophiainstitute.com and you can find it there. Just search on my name or on Deadly Indifference. And essentially, I'm talking about the idea there of that most Catholics don't think it's very important to be Catholic. And we need to remember how important it is to be Catholic. It's you know, salvation dependent. So that's really what the focus of the book is.
Excellent. Sophia, the purveyor of good books. I'm excited to pick yours up. Mine on Sophia, called The Case for Patriarchy, which will be coming out in 2 months in late September, is up for pre-order now. People go.
It is. Okay, pre-order. Good.
It's up. It's been a long struggle, a storied struggle, I'm afraid to say, to get this book out. But Sophia is so intrepid. They're awesome. They've gotten it out. And this is going to be one of the most controversial books in late 2021. So go to Sophia. They like you buying directly from them, pre-ordering directly from them. I think you can do so on Amazon, but go to Sophia and pre-order Case for Patriarchy now. Also, do read Crisis Magazine. It's one of my regular internet stops if I have 5 minutes at the bus station or wherever. I don't ride buses, but it's better than saying the bathroom.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We all know where you're reading it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Google Analytics says about 90% of our readers read it. No, I'm just kidding.
it's a fact. It's a brute fact of modern life. Also, I will say this. Look, I don't like to pester, but I'm told to pester more by everyone who does this. People, please subscribe, hit the bell for notification, and do hit like on this video. It's gay, but these things matter quite a bit. And it's a fact that I resisted for too long because I don't like to be a nag. No one likes a gadfly. But subscribe, click the bell, hit like. Also, the Rules for Retrogrades Classical Academy is now up and running. Go to timothyjgordon.com. We will help you to homeschool your kids. Lots of people are on the fence. 1.6 million parents pulled their kids out of the public school last year, but they're intimidated, particularly for subjects like Latin and algebra. Hand that over to me. Go to timothyjgordon.com and click enroll. Also, I've become widely noted for urging people to do as I did, get from the bluest of the blue states to the reddest of the red. It's part of being a good Republican, is a Republican citizen, is you get to pick your mini republic, your state. Get where people are good. Even if they're Protestant, they're good. I have good neighbors here. Do so by going to realestateforlife.org. You get to pick your neighbors, pick good ones. Get out of California, New York, Oregon, wherever it's blue, get out. realestateforlife.org will help you to do this. Finally, I hate to bother you people, but we need help, particularly as we're going to come under the, let's say, scrutiny, more like crosshairs of the secular left as the case for patriarchy gets ready to come out. It's already happening. You can help us most by one, buying the book. Go get it on pre-order at Sophia Institute. And two, on a more rolling basis, support us on Patreon, even if it's only $5 a month. It makes a big difference. We really appreciate it. Also read Crisis Magazine. Pick up Eric Sammons' new book, Deadly Indifference. It's been out for about a month and a half, and it's doing very well. God bless you, Eric. Thanks for coming on, bud.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
All right, everyone, Deus Vult.